From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. More than 400 large U.S. military drones have crashed in accidents all around the world. That's since 2001, according to an investigation by the Washington Post, highlighting the danger posed by these technologies. A key weapon in the war on terror, drones look set to become part of America's airspace thanks to a law passed in 2012. Commercial and law enforcement use of drones expected to increase significantly over the coming years. So far, 400 large U.S. military drones have crashed. The National Park Service has announced that it's prohibiting drones from flying over its controlled lands and waters. That includes 84 million acres in every state and territory, including monuments, battlefields, historic sites, seashores, rivers, and trails. What do they know that some don't? Several companies have agreed to incorporate the kill switch technology into their mobile operating systems in an upcoming update, according to a new report. The New York State Attorney General this week released a review of its Secure Our Smartphone initiative, which it kicked off last year with San Francisco and London officials in order to cut down on mobile device theft. But could it be a problem for other things, like Big Brother shutting you down? Let's check in with the expert on all technologies, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, first and foremost, a switch to shut off your phone. How would that work?
Yeah, in fact, this isn't even really too new, because there have been apps that people could load to do this and ways to enable this for quite some time now. The principle here is that, you know, when people rip off your cell phone, they usually do it because it's very easy just to reprogram it for a new account and resell it and keep using it the way it would normally be used. If there's a way for a subscriber, when they realize their phone has been stolen, to remotely order the phone to shut down and to erase itself and lock, that makes it much more difficult to reprogram and to resell. Not necessarily impossible in all cases, but enough of a hassle that it's been proving to really reduce the number of phones that are stolen that are locked that way. There really aren't any government or Big Brother issues here, because when you think about it, there's always been a way for the government to shut down your cell phone. All they have to do is go to the cellular carrier
and shut that down.
And shut it down from the cellular carrier. So really what this service is, this concept is a way for users, usually on an opt-in basis, to say, hey, my cell phone was stolen. I want to turn this off here. Delete all my private information from it, because who knows who has it now. Wipe it clean. Lock it. Now I don't have to worry about all my contacts and financial information and stuff being in the hands of who knows who. That's really what this is about. But what they're trying to do is to organize it, put it into a systematic fashion so that, to a certain extent, it'll work in a similar way across all these different kinds of products.
Interesting technology. Lauren, thanks. You have yourself a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, George.
Islamist-led militants and pro-government forces engaged right now in fierce battles for an oil refinery in Iraq and the Tal Afar airport in northern Iraq. Iraq's biggest refinery is surrounded by the rebels, who say they have seized most of the Tal Afar airport. The fighting comes a day after the U.S. said it would send some 300 military advisors to help fight against the insurgents. I have no idea how the advisors are going to fight against the insurgents. Florida Governor Rick Scott has signed a law that builds on the state's controversial Stand Your Ground self-defense rules by now allowing citizens to brandish weapons and fire warning shots to ward off an attacker. In Maine, an 18-year-old high school student has died just days after undergoing oral surgery. He contracted a rare flesh-eating bacteria merely by going to the dentist. Southern California residents, baffled by a group of mysterious lights seen hovering in the sky over the last couple days. Let's check in with the expert from the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport. Peter, are you getting reports on this one?
Oh, are we indeed, George. In fact, I'm delighted to be on tonight, because over the last couple of weeks, and I think it's been 2 weeks since I've reported on Coast, I've just been deluged with reports And I've got about a half a dozen of them that are really exciting, really interesting. I'd like to go back to the 12th of June, Thursday night of last week. Got a number of reports from Mesa, Arizona, which is out east of Phoenix a ways, just east of Sky Harbor Airport. People were reporting they were looking to the west and northwest, and they saw an estimated 30 orange fireballs hovering, in their opinion, close, very close to Sky Harbor Airport. I mention that fact because the FAA, if they didn't know about orange fireballs a year ago,
they do now.
They must know about them now. And I've got a few more reports about them, even more dramatic than that. But people estimated that those objects on the 12th of June were very close to Sky Harbor Airport. The next morning, 06:45 hours Pacific time, a gentleman reports he was flying his Cessna 150 over Lake Havasu City, Arizona. He was flying from east to west. He was at 8,500 feet. He looked up ahead of his aircraft, and at his 11 o'clock position, he saw a red metallic sphere that appeared to be streaking towards his aircraft just off the left wing of his aircraft. As it got to the left of his plane, it appeared to slow. He estimates that it passed within 40 feet of the tip of his left-hand wing. Really an interesting report, and people can read that report on our website. It's now posted. Wednesday night of this week, June 18th, you've probably heard about this already. People from places like Mission Viejo, Oceanside.
Yes, all over the place.
All over. This is, what is that, 40 miles southeast of Los Angeles, would
you
estimate?
Yeah, a little bit more. But
people were looking out to sea, they said. They saw at least two very bright orange objects that were just hovering, and they weren't just flickering. They were turning off and then coming back on, re-illuminating, to coin a term, if I may. And you probably saw the reports on some of the television stations. Interestingly, one of the stations reported that the Marine Corps at Camp Pendleton reported that they did not have any activities going on at that time. No flares, no aircraft in the air, et cetera, et cetera. Another station reported that the Marine Corps did report that they had activities going on. So obviously those stations are not listening to coast nearly frequently enough to get the real story. Last night, Denver, Colorado, a man and his wife saw a very interesting red fireball in the southwestern sky from their home in Denver. They looked at it with a spotting scope, and they could see, with magnification, they could see that the object was maneuvering, and it was not a sphere, it was a disc-shaped craft, metallic in appearance. Tonight, just 4 hours ago, this is a very interesting report, George. I got a telephone call just about 6 or 7 o'clock tonight from a gentleman who is a former U.S. Navy fighter pilot, now retired. He flew in the mid-70s. He's from Murrells Inlet, South Carolina, up on the northeastern shoreline of South Carolina. He was standing outside looking at the beautiful night sky about 8:35 p.m. and he saw four yellow lights streaking at him. He estimated they were closing on him at about 150 knots, and they suddenly split into two groups of two, and they accelerated, they pitched up, and they flew into clouds in the night sky over South Carolina.
Peter, well, with all these reports, and I would think most of them can be explained, you know, as ours or some kind of natural event, but the ones that we really can't explain, and there's a percent in there, what do you think these things are?
I'm struggling with that question, and I am very worried. You've heard me express my concern.
Yeah,
on a few occasions.
That's right.
These objects. I'm a pilot. I'm a commercial pilot. I've served as a flight instructor. I know generally which end of the airplane is supposed to point forward. these objects, these reports that I'm receiving have absolute, from my vantage point, in my opinion, most of them, the overwhelming majority of them, have no terrestrial explanation for them.
Nothing.
And I'll close with a very interesting sighting I just received from the St. Louis area.
Wow.
An area that means a lot to you,
just
means a lot to me. That's where I grew up.
That's
where I had my first UFO sighting. O'Fallon, Missouri, out west of St. Peter's, tonight at 8:45 p.m. local time, a man was driving on Route 40, headed eastbound towards St. Peter's and St. Charles. He saw an orange fireball directly ahead of him, and he realized quickly that it was closing on his car very, very rapidly. He stuck his head out the car. How you do that when you're driving on the interstate, I don't know.
It's not easy.
He reports that he looked up at it directly above his car, flew right over his car. So there are probably other witnesses who were on the highway. And he could see it as it went away from him. Again, I don't know how he could arrange to do this, but he reports that as it was flying directly west behind him, away from him, all he could see is a dark splotch in the sky. He could no longer see orange light. And the last report, just took it over the telephone, a report from your neck of the woods, George, Pico Rivera, just east of East Los Angeles, a cluster of 5 orange lights. So keep your eyes open down there.
Something's
tonight.
Happening. Thanks for the round robin report. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. You know, I was born in Michigan, so I'm very familiar with the Great Lakes. What's been going on there? Up next, Charles Cassidy Jr. joins us. His latest work, Great Lakes Folklore, next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back Friday night and the Saturday morning crowd. Charles Cassidy Jr. spent decades as a traveler through parallel universes and alternative realities. How did he do that? Well, he was really a film critic. That's it. For such publishers as TV Guide, Visible Ink Press, numerous other northern regional Ohio newspapers. Now, back in 2008, he started writing books on mysterious things, the paranormal, the American Midwest, the Great Lakes region, including Cleveland Ghosts, Paranormal Great Lakes, Paranormal Mississippi River, his latest, Great Lakes Folklore. Charles, exciting, exciting, exciting things you've been doing.
I like to think so, yes. I just caution that I'm in the tradition of my namesake, the great Charles Fort, more or less the founder and our patron saint of the paranormal studies. He spent most of his research existence, though, in libraries and archives. Did not very often sally out into the field. I'm that sort of researcher too. When it comes to this, I collect the stories, look up old manuscripts, microfilm. Remember microfilm?
Oh yeah, the internet. Long time ago. That's right.
I swear, sometimes if I ever find a picture of that stuff for sale, or behind thrown out behind a library, I'll just grab it to see what's in there.
Isn't it amazing what we had to do to get information in those days?
Oh, yes, yes. And now it's all at our fingertips, but again, is it reliable? And was the microfilm reliable? Well, as a journalist, I can tell you it took a little bit more effort to produce, so perhaps there's more accuracy there. But that, again, that falls to my judgment as I write and compile these books. That Charles Fort had a great introduction to his very first book, The Book of the Damned, that I was rereading tonight, that, you know, we shall show
that's
a procession of
big
data.
Big book, too, isn't it?
Well, they recently republished all 4 of his books in one volume. The Book of the Damned is actually quite small, but when you get all four of them together...
Huge. That's what I've got.
You've got a telephone directory. And while Fort makes this wonderful statement of principles about the collection of the damned, the things excluded by science, not recognized, swept under the rug, but put them together and they'll march. But I much prefer a more succinct phrase. I just have a weakness for marvels. Another writer, Rupert Gould, said that, and that's a weakness for marvels. And even my newspaper career, even when I was more or less an entertainment light feature writer, it would always, something that was curious and strange that would stick out for me, I would grab it, clip it, throw it in my menacing-looking black folder, and know that I had a possible story for Halloween.
And you were ready
Halloween
to go.
Column. Yeah, the easy fill, as they say in the newspaper business. And over time, that black folder just got thicker and thicker. And eventually I found a publisher, a wonderful publisher in Pennsylvania, Schiffer Books, who wanted such information, wanted to collect it and present it for the various regions of the country. But I think that anyone, I would like to think, that anybody from Maine to California would be interested in the stories I present from the Great Lakes, from Mississippi, even from Cleveland.
Cleveland, coming from Detroit, so I'm really familiar with Cleveland, and of course with my Tigers playing your Indians all the time.
About that.
But, what's going on in terms of newspapers these days, Charles, that, and we're going to dive deep into your books here, but the newspaper business has gotten clobbered by the Internet, hasn't it?
That's true, though before that it was getting clobbered by television. So I'm sorry to say that the decline was in progress by the time I wisely chose my major in journalism at Syracuse University. Obviously, I lack the power of clairvoyance and precognition. But, newspapers, and it's sad, they are, and use another classic phrase, the first draft of history, and lots of great information that we draw on for these stories is come out of these yellowing newspapers. I hope they never truly go away, but they've been downsized, outsourced, to the extent that a lot of our news reading is these days, I find, is being actually driven by foreign correspondents, who I assume are cheaper to handle and syndicate, and that's why we followed the adventures of David and Victoria Beckham and other people so much more closely than I think we would otherwise if we still had our three or four daily newspapers in every town.
Did you ever know an old friend of mine who used to write in Cleveland? I think he's freelance now, John Urbanich.
Name is familiar. I may have met him once or twice on the entertainment beat. I was a more or less full-time freelancer, not a staffer, and seldom invited.
He wrote for the Sun newspapers out that way.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, I actually photographed for the Sun newspapers reason. Yeah, did not break into the editorial side.
Well, how did you make the switch? You were a film critic. How did you make the switch into the paranormal? Was this just a hobby for you, or what?
Movies, paranormal, weirdness, what's the difference? I think I find a parallel in the illustrious Richard Roper, too. On the side, he writes about urban legends and conspiracy theories. I think there's a natural trade-off between the two. I've always been interested in the paranormal and the strange. I grew up reading avidly books by Ivan T. Sanderson, and you would not find me in school without my backpack would contain the Guinness Book of World Records and as many Ripley's Believe It or Not paperbacks as I could cram in there. There was a natural bias inclination there. The fascination with film, cinema, what can I say? They do a very good job promoting it. It was always the first part of the newspaper I'd turn to every day until I do better. And graduated from college with a long shot book contract, of all things. I answered a box ad in Variety and wound up with a book contract with a movie review publication halfway around the world in a small town in France. It was actually a Dutch publisher that were in France for tax purposes, but they needed an American correspondent, and that got me what we call in the business accreditation.
And there you were. Charles, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back and get into the Great Lakes folklore and see what's out there. All kinds of incredible stories. I'm George Norrie, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Cassidy Jr. with us, his work, Great Lakes Folklore. How did you then begin to do the research for Great Lakes Folklore, Charles? Where did you go? How did you start?
Stood on the proverbial shoulders of giants, especially a gentleman who, in a way, Great Lakes Folklore is, I don't want to call it an act of revenge, but there was a wonderful historian and lakefront reporter who worked in Cleveland and Toledo. His name was Dwight Boyer. He died in 1978. He wrote and articles about the waterfront, Great Lakes shipping, maritime disasters, and put them together, all his knowledge, in five different books, including True Tales of the Great Lakes, Ghost Ships of the Great Lakes, especially Ships and Men of the Great Lakes, that I think are classics referred to in their field. However, at a very young, impressionable, still, like I say, reading Loch Ness Monster and ghost story accounts as a kid, I was gifted a copy of Mr. Boyer's Ghost Ships of the Great Lakes. I enjoyed reading it to the extent I could comprehend it, but it struck me early on, where are all those ghosts? The cover says ghosts. I'm expecting my ghosts.
Where'd they go?
I was like Cartman from South Park. Later, when I reread it a little bit more advanced in age, it finally dawned on me that in maritime speak, when they say ghost ships, it is not necessarily a ship that is a ghost. That properly is a phantom ship. Actually, two species, the phantom ship and the spectral ship. We can get into that later. But a ghost ship is just referred to any ship that vanishes and leaves a little or no wreckage, no bodies, just nothing behind it but a mystery of what could have happened to it. And
we've had a lot of those out there.
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, I suppose you could say the ship in the Perfect Storm became a ghost ship because just swallowed up by the Atlantic without a trace. Doesn't necessarily mean anything supernatural, paranormal intervened. Could have, but it's really more a mystery, an absence, a ghost. I'm ghost, as the kids say these days before they head off somewhere and your parents don't know where. And such is the same thing with ships. And a little parenthetically, it's very curious to me, maybe worthy of comment, that this figure of speech has not crossed over, obviously, into the aviation field. Otherwise, we'd be talking about that Malaysian airliner as a ghost plane, as it seems to have done a tantalizing and very disturbing vanishing act, just as so many ships have over the years. But yet, that nomenclature has not caught on. Strikes me as interesting.
You haven't had a lot of paranormal experiences personally, have you?
No, I'm quite upfront about that. Well, I stand corrected. The day I was booked on the show, I was downstairs in my basement, and we have an old refrigerator down there that I mainly used to store old video cassettes I was sent to review. Suddenly, the door swung open and shut on it for no reason that I could discern. And here, I was probably thinking along the lines of, I know, I'll brag about how I've never had any paranormal experiences.
And then bang.
Yeah, ruined it for me.
That's old Benjamin. He does that to all our guests. He's out there.
Or Forrest J. Ackerman, from what I've heard.
Could have been.
taking away my main talking point, but no, I really can't say I have had beyond just a curious dream now and then and a feeling of deja vu and being raised, trained as a newspaper man, sort of, a reporter designed to be skeptical, ask questions. You'd ask, why would I then not be a professional debunker? And some people who have read my work say that I am a skeptic.
That's healthy, I think.
Right. And I think sometimes the skeptics, not the real hardcore, but some of them, they will point out information alternatives, ideas that believers in paranormal just would not necessarily occur to them. So there's a good use for that. However, I also find that too many sincere accounts reported to me, some personally, others I pick up from multiple sources, that I just cannot completely rule out a fantastic claim, even though I try to hold on to that idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence before they're entered in fact. I just go into it as a reporter, a storyteller perhaps, but offering all sides, as many as I can, and try to make it interesting.
Have you come out, Charles, baffled with some of these stories?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And as have many individuals who look into it and just cannot make head or tail of why these things happen. I think there's an old British expression, stranger things happen at sea. And that applies as much to the Great Lakes, the inland seas, as to the saltwater variety.
Now, is there a big difference between the paranormal Great Lakes, paranormal Mississippi River, two of your past books, with the new one, Great Lakes Folklore?
Yes, Great Lakes Folklore was my attempt to sort of go do Dwight Boyer one better. I wanted to write a book that I think he could have produced if he kept ghosts in it, and maybe shed the spotlight on a few stories that, very few stories, I should say, that eluded his superb storytelling and his grasp of history. So I compiled some of my favorites. I also, having to live up to the title Folklore, I attempted to maybe check out a few tales that needed some myth-busting, and my favorite ghosts and tall stories. So I think I wound up with a very nice, readable historical volume that, pound for pound, probably has less of the paranormal in it than my past books do. However, it's just a great read and great popular history, and I find a direct comparison between Oliver Hazard Perry and Captain Kirk. Else would do that?
How did you key in on the Great Lakes? Merely because you live in that region?
Yes, I think so. Could I have written this book without living here? Quite possibly. What really fascinates me, again, I'm coming from a position of 25 years serving as a film critic. I make it sound like a prison sentence, and sometimes it did feel like one. But viewing all that artifice, all that storytelling, it got me thinking a lot about culture and cultural backgrounds. And the area that I live in Cleveland, and you, of course, Detroit, we think of these cities, Milwaukee, whatever, is they're industrial, they're manufacturing, they're modern, yet they sit perched on one of the greatest bodies of fresh water in the world. 20% of all fresh water is on the Great Lakes. These are small oceans, really. And you go back 100 years, a photograph of the Detroit waterfront, the Cleveland waterfront, you will see three-masted sailing vessels.
That's right. And they are violent also. Look at Lake Superior.
Yes. Superior and even the shallower ones, Ontario and Erie, can be very unpredictable even just for that very reason. But so it fascinated me to think that there's this whole other world here, the flip side of the steel mills and the Detroit Tigers and the modern day. Then you just walk north into the lake, and it seems you're part of a maritime tradition that goes back hundreds, thousands of years. And with it, on the Great Lakes, you will find, if you look hard enough, sea serpents, mermaids, the phantom ships and the spectral ships, anything that's the reflections of the supernatural, the superstitions and the stories that are told on the oceans since back to the days of Sinbad the Sailor. I found that that's a roundabout way, a great word that I found in my research is circumbendibus, so sort of a fake Latin word that the British use for something that follows a long, tortured, twisted path and takes forever to get to the point. That's how I talk.
Now, and when we talk about folklore, are we talking about myths and everything else that would fit into that category?
Some of that, yes. My idea of folklore is more like the way some of these stories have been distorted by time, been sometimes misunderstood, mispromoted, and I sort of deliberated, especially how whether to include a chapter of the rich history of Indian legends of the tribes on the Great Lakes. But then I consulted with a very well-known Ojibwe woman, Lois Beardsley, a great artist. She contributed a little an article to Great Lakes Folklore, and she kind of sent me straight that so much of that was European invention, and not very good European invention at that, that I ended up scrapping her that whole chapter. I might return to it in a future book and actually try to sift through and try to distinguish the real folklore from the fake folklore when it came to the Europeans and the Indians. So I try to stay with sort of a more modern type of folklore, the idea that floated that there was this helmsman on Lake Erie who sacrificed his life to steer a burning ship to safety, and he died a hero's death, and we have monuments to him up and down the lakes. This is believed by most of the German-speaking people. This helmsman never really existed in real life. It was a complete
fabrication, the whole thing.
Not exactly. It grew out of a genuine ship disaster, but a writer named Charles Dickens, who traveled on the Great Lakes in the mid-19th century, heard of the disaster, wrote a fictitious story based upon it, and
it became truth, I guess.
In a poet and Horatio Alger and others picked up on the idea of a helmsman in a burning ship sacrificing himself to get the ship to safety. A poet named Theodore Fontaine gave the man the name John Maynard. And to this day, you can look on YouTube, you will find good German citizens reciting, where is John Maynard? This epic poem of sacrifice and duty, and yet John Maynard actually did not exist. A man named Augustus Fuller existed. Not only did he die at the wheel, but so did most of the people on board the ship. It was a terrible disaster, and so I felt that qualified as a sort of a modern folklore, and to this day Germans will come to Buffalo looking for the gigantic marble monument to John Maynard and only see maybe they finally put up a small commemorative plaque.
Do you think that most myths, Charles, are based on some truth, but that they just fall by the wayside?
Yes. I do think there are grains of them as to what the truth is. It's very difficult to determine from our vantage point. When I was writing, especially about the Mississippi River, I did allow myself to look into some of the Indian legends, the ones that especially grew out of the discovery of the Indians knew, of course, what fossils were. They knew they were the gigantic bones of dead animals. They just had no scientific, as we would know, the theory to account for them. So Indian legends of that period of the Mississippi created these wonderful menagerie of beasts and spirit animals of which these bones were remnants. And so it's a question, I guess, of sifting through in the modern stories to get to those bones and try to put flesh on them, figure out, if it can be figured out, what really did happen.
What was one of your favorite stories of the Great Lakes folklore that you uncovered?
This one is, you know, I knew you were going to ask that, and I was racking my brain. Which one should I mention? Can I give you two?
Yeah, you sure can.
There is a wonderful story reported that, again, sadly, no attribution, no names, no affidavits, especially no photos, and he could have taken them, that in 1940, a tugboat captain was nearly rammed by an antique steamer, and he was very angry. He boarded it, found out that this was on Lake Superior, found it to be a quite antiquated design. The crew were basically like zombies, looked like zombies. They didn't talk to him. They just motioned him to go to the wheelhouse. And he was informed, this is again 1940, remember, he was informed that he was on board a ship called the Hudson, which sank on September 16, 1901, loss of all hands. They are forced by the devil to every year on the anniversary of their sinking rise from the watery grave and sail again. And if this tugboat captain does not get off the ship pronto, he'll be forced to join them. True, Pirates of the Caribbean stuff here. And so the captain quickly disembarks and barely escapes the teeth of a terrible storm, which would have otherwise taken his life. That's a story, again, that sounds like something that you would hear in the 1500s, and it would have been old even then. But it supposedly has been told around Lake Superior since the 1940s. That's a nice story. That's really cute, and Dan tells me how this folklore functions and still flourishes in a maritime environment, even in modern times, even in the so-called space age. Now, another story I have in unique to Great Lakes folklore. This is more factuate, yet a lot of mystery. A man named Laudner Phillips. He shows up in a lot of Great Lakes history books with these two sentences. He invented and tested submarines in the Great Lakes in the 1850s. One day he took his whole family for a pleasure excursion to the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Huh.
That's what you hear about Laudner Phillips. And I
did he come back up?
In some stories he does. But I had to find out. There's got to be more to it than this. Dwight Boyer did not have anything about Laudner Phillips in all his books, unless I missed something. So I finally did some digging. A very helpful lady, Patricia Gruz Harris, has written about him. This Laudner Phillips was an amazing character, an inventor in Michigan City, Indiana, in the 1840s and 50s. He enthralled at the idea of working on the family farm, so he started inventing submarines. This is the 1850s. This is 30 years before 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is published by Jules Verne. And this Laudner Phillips was building submarines. He got rather good at it from what little we can determine.
I guess so, yeah.
He possibly built as many as four. Problem is that a lot of his work was done in Chicago, and records of his exploits were just lost in the Great Chicago Fire. So Phillips tried to interest the United States Navy in the concept of a submarine. He'd actually mounted his with guns. He had the capability to sink ships. He promoted them for underwater salvage exercises. There was a sign. We have indications that the during the Civil War there might have been some weak interest from the Union caused War Department, but not much. And Phillips died in an accident, kind of a very suspicious circumstances. Not long after he got into an altercation with someone and died of his injuries, but he, in the meantime, built an indeterminate number of submarines, which kept sort of popping up in various forms. And one of them was apparently fished out of the Chicago River in 1915. I reproduced the photo from the Chicago newspapers. Another mystery, press photographers were on hand to see this thing that looks like a rocket ship coming out of the Chicago River.
What a great story. Charles, hold on. We're going to come back and talk more. I want to also get into your paranormal Great Lakes and paranormal Mississippi River when we come right back.